You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. For the last several days, I've been immersed in two memoirs, Eve Ensler's In the Body of the World and My Name is Jody Williams, A Vermont Girl's Winding Path to the Nobel Peace Prize. And through the eyes of these two extraordinary women, I've traveled to war-torn Bosnia, to a clinic for rape survivors in Congo, to the front lines of the conflicts in El Salvador and Nicaragua. I've been witness to a private moment in a hospital room where an artist deathly ill from cancer finds that a tree outside the window can be a great teacher. Through this vicarious journey to such difficult places, strangely, I've been filled with feelings of great hope. Eve Ensler and Jody Williams are two activists of such deep passion and rare honesty who understand the relationship between a gash in the flesh and the rip in the ozone, the violation of the body and the violation of the earth. Eve Ensler is an internationally best-selling author and an award-winning playwright whose theatrical works include, as you know, The Vagina Monologues, Necessary Targets, and The Good Body. She's the author of Insecure at Last, a political memoir, and I Am an Emotional Creature. And Eve is the founder of V-Day, the global movement to end violence against women and girls. How many of you have participated in a V-Day event? Woo! That's great. And which also inspired the global action 1 Billion Rising. And Jody Williams, who received the 1997 Nobel Peace Prize for her work to ban landmines, is founding chair of the Nobel Women's Initiative, launched in January 2006. And at dinner, Jody was telling me how on the way to her Air Talk interview, she was calling to say she was running a little late, and she actually got busted for talking on her cell phone. And I said, well, didn't you tell him you were a Nobel Peace Prize laureate? She never pulls out that card. She's a campaign ambassador for the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, which she helped found in 1992. And in 2012-13, she became the inaugural Jane Addams Distinguished Visiting Fellow in Social Justice at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And we are very fortunate tonight, really fortunate, to have Pat Mitchell as our interlocutor. Pat has been involved with V-Day since 1999, when she traveled to Bosnia to witness the first production of Eve's Necessary Targets. Her insight and dedication to V-Day and the mission to end violence against women and girls has been instrumental to the success of the movement over the last 10 years. She produces award-winning documentaries as executive in charge of original productions for Ted Turner's cable networks, has been recognized with 44 Emmy Awards, 5 Peabody's, and 2 Academy Award nominations, and she is currently present CEO of the Paley Center for Media. What an honor it is to welcome Eve Ensler, Jody Williams, and Pat Mitchell to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
That was beautiful. Thank you. Good evening. Oh, it's so great to see all of you here. Thank you for making the effort to come to this beautiful theater and join us for what I think is going to be a memorable evening. And may I just say, Louise, that was a beautiful introduction.
Beautiful.
Thank you so much. And thank you for the work that you do and the Library Foundation does by offering these kinds of programs night after night. We feel it's a great privilege to be in this theater and to be carrying on this tradition. And speaking of privileges, it truly is one for me tonight because these two women are very, very dear, close friends of mine. And we just hope we'll be friends when this is over. You never know, you know, when you're interviewing friends. Yeah, sometimes you know more than you're supposed to know, so you don't know if you're going to move a little, you know, get a little too close. I'll just apologize up front, just in case. But what I love about this opportunity is what I know and admire about them, as you do, from a great distance, and what I also know and love and admire them as dear friends are the things that I want to share with you tonight. Because in their stories and in their work are the kind of role models that do have application for each and every one of us in our own lives. Incredibly inspiring, yes. But beyond that, who they are as people is so... I think you're creating a wind tunnel.
That's you.
Yes, it is you.
It is not.
Yeah, it is.
You can't blow a fan. I thought it was a giant rat in the ceiling.
Yeah, I thought it might be thunder, but... You know, I really can't take Jody anywhere. The last time she and I did an interview together, we took our shoes off.
I have mine off already.
So, it was ostensibly to level the playing field. So we may all have to do
no,
that
I'm
at
not
some point. Okay.
I just had a pedicure today, so I could.
Okay, I did not have a pedicure. So
to get us started on this journey into personal memoirs, and this journey into understanding more about this world-changing, life-changing, transformative work that these two women lead. I want to begin with their books, because in each instance, they have written books that do just that, interweave their personal narratives with the narratives of their work. And as Louise pointed out so beautifully, and even beyond their work to the bigger global issues of which we are all a part. I, like her, could not put either book down. Have returned to both of them several times over the past several months. So I have asked Jody and Eve to select their own selections to begin our conversation, and then we'll share another passage at the end. So Jody, may I ask you to begin?
Bear with me. I'm not an excellent reader, but I will try very hard. And I won't use my fan. It was a gray, damp, cold February day in 1981, the kind that typifies winter in Washington, D.C. I was walking fast down Connecticut Avenue, my cowboy boots hitting the pavement decisively. I've had a strong gait almost since I could walk. From time to time, I'd try to teach myself to glide ladylike across the floor. It never took. That afternoon, I was headed for the nearest metro stop to catch a train home to Arlington, getting as far away from work as I could. When I reached the escalator descending deeply into the metro trains, I hesitated to adjust my pace to the movement of the stairs. Just then, a scruffy-looking fellow stepped forward and stuffed a pamphlet into my chest. The first thing I noticed was the mimeograph ink on the cheap paper already staining my hand. I was about ready to curse it rather foully when the four words on the cover came into focus: El Salvador, another Vietnam. I couldn't imagine a link between Vietnam and a tiny country in Central America that most of us could not identify on the map. When I finally sat down and read that faithful little brochure, the information it outlined in spare bullet points described how my tax dollars were being used to support a war few of us knew about. I was feeling not only frustrated with my life at the time, but powerless in the face of U.S. interventionist foreign policy, especially after the election of Ronald Reagan. However, instead of giving in to those feelings and doing nothing, I decided to go to the meeting about the war in El Salvador that the pamphlet announced for the coming week. The night of the meeting about El Salvador arrived, and I went, very early. It's a trait carried over from grade school. As a child, I'd arrive in the morning before the doors were even unlocked because I was so afraid I'd get a tardy mark on my report card. I wasn't in grade school anymore, but I still didn't want to be late. As I went down the stairs into the church's basement, I could see a handful of people seated randomly on folding chairs, arranged around an empty spot for the speaker. I sat over in the corner so I could slink out more easily in case it was a terrible presentation. I imagine I was hoping to see a Salvadoran version of Ernesto Che Guevara. He was hot, after all. Wasn't he? But the man who spoke was not a super hot revolutionary in olive drab wearing a dashing beret. Mario Velasquez was an attractive, chubby sophisticate in a three-piece pinstripe suit. He was charismatic and spoke with a passion and clarity that might well have rivaled those of the famous revolutionary, however. He didn't simply spew out facts and figures about U.S. involvement in his country. He wove the information through a personal telling of how attempts at building democracy in Salvador had been crushed, and his father, a famous colonel, was part of the crushing of that democracy. Listening to Mario talk that night rekindled the anger and confusion I'd felt about the U.S. during its war in Vietnam. How could this country continue to talk about democracy and self-determination while at the same time supporting dictators and militaries that stopped attempts at democratic change in their countries? But I realized that dismay wouldn't accomplish a thing, and anger is not a strategy for change. The only thing that might help would be to do something to make it different. So when a sign-up sheet came for volunteers at the end of the meeting, I added my name. Even now, when I think back to that meeting, I can't quite believe that I went. It wasn't surprising that I'd read the brochure given the title, nor was it surprising that I was indignant enough at that moment to think about going to the meeting. That I had followed through and attended it a week later really amazes me. And quite honestly, to this day, it is something I do not understand. Because as the fire of indignation or inspiration burns lower and lower, it is way too easy to find excuses to settle back into the routine of the familiar and to do nothing.
Thank you, Jody.
That was
beautiful. Okay, so this is a little different. This book is written in the form of scans, as in CAT scans, because I had a lot of them over the course of my cancer treatment and became quite obsessed with CAT scans. And I think they're quite amazing because the computer takes individual shots of the body and then it makes them appear as one. And I think it's a really beautiful literary idea that we have these fragmented stories that we tell in fractured ways, but cumulatively they can add up to be one. This is the introduction. It's a little bit longer. I hope that's okay. But it's called Divided, and here it goes. A mother's body against a child's body makes a place. It says, you are here. Without this body pressed against your body, there is no place. I envy people who miss their mother or miss a place or know something called home. The absence of a body against my body created a gap, a hole, a hunger. This hunger determined my life. I have been exiled from my body. I was ejected at a very young age, and I got lost. I did not have a baby. I have been afraid of trees. I have felt the earth as my enemy. I did not live in the forest. I lived in the concrete city where I could not see the sky or sunset or stars. I moved at the pace of engines, and it was faster than my own breath. I became a stranger to myself and to the rhythms of the earth. I aggrandized my alien identity and wore black and felt superior. My body was a burden. I saw it as something that unfortunately had to be maintained. I had little patience for its needs. The absence of a body against my body made attachment abstract, made my own body dislocated and unable to rest or settle. A body pressed against your body is the beginning of nest. I grew up not in a home, but in a kind of free fall of anger and violence that led to a life of constant movement, of leaving and falling. It is why at one point I couldn't stop drinking and fucking, why I needed people to touch me all the time. It had less to do with sex than location. When you press against me or put yourself inside me, when you hold me down or lift me up, when you lie on top of me, I can feel your weight. I exist. I am here. For years, I've been trying to get back into my body, to the earth. I guess you could say it has been a preoccupation. Although I have felt pleasure in both the earth and the body, it has been more as a visitor than as an inhabitant. I tried many forms and many routes to get back. Promiscuity, anorexia, performance art. I've spent time by the Adriatic and in the green Vermont mountains, but always I felt estranged, just as I was estranged from my own mother. I was in awe of her beauty, but could not find my way in. Her breasts were not the breasts that fed me. Everyone admired my mother in her tight tops and leggings with her hair in a blonde French twist as she drove through our small, rich town in her yellow convertible. One gawked at my mother. One desired my mother, and so I gawked and desired the earth and my mother, and I despised my own body, which was not her body, my body that I had been forced to evacuate when my father invaded and violated me. And so I lived as a breathless, rapacious machine programmed for striving and accomplishment. Because I did not inhabit my body or the earth, I could not know or feel their pain. And I most certainly never knew the boundaries of enough. I was driven, I called it, working hard, being busy on top of it, making things happen, but in fact, I could not stop. Stopping would mean experiencing separation, loss, tumbling into a suicidal dislocation. As I had no reference point for my body, I began to ask other women about their bodies, in particular, their vaginas. I sensed vaginas were important. This led me to writing the Vagina Monologues, which led me to talking incessantly, obsessively about vaginas everywhere. I did this in front of strangers. As a result of me talking so much about vaginas, women started telling me about their vaginas and their bodies. I crisscrossed the earth in planes, trains, and jeeps. I was hungry for the stories of other women who had experienced violence and suffering. These women and girls had also been exiled from their bodies, and they too were desperate for a way home. I went to over 60 countries. I heard about women being molested in their beds, flogged in their burqas, acid burned in their kitchens, left for dead in parking lots. Then I went somewhere else. I went outside what I thought I knew. I went to the Congo, and I heard stories that shattered all the other stories. In 2007, I landed in Bukavu, Democratic Republic of Congo. I heard stories that got inside my body. I heard about a little girl who couldn't stop peeing on herself because huge men had shoved themselves inside her. I heard about an 80-year-old woman whose legs were broken and torn out of the sockets when the soldiers pulled them over her head and raped her. There were thousands of these stories. The stories saturated my cells and nerves, and I stopped sleeping. All the stories began to bleed together. The raping of the earth, the pillaging of minerals, the destruction of the vagina, they were not separate from each other or from me. In the Congo, there has been a war raging for almost 13 years. Nearly 8 million people have died, and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of women have been raped and tortured. It is an economic war fought over minerals that belong to the Congolese but are pillaged by the world. The minerals are abundant in the Congo. Tin, copper, coltane, which are used in our iPhones, our PlayStations, and computers. Of course, by the time I got to Congo, I had witnessed the epidemic of violence toward women that scoured the planet. But the Congo is where I witnessed the end of the body, the end of humanity. Femicide, the systematic rape, torture, and destruction of women and girls, was being employed as a military corporate tactic to secure minerals. The Congo and the individual horror stories of her women consumed me. Here I began to see the future, a monstrous vision of global disassociation and greed that not only allowed but encouraged the eradication of the female species in pursuit of minerals and wealth. But I found something else in the Congo as well. Inside the stories of unspeakable violence, inside the women of the Congo was a determination and life force I had never witnessed. There was grace and gratitude, fierceness and readiness. Inside this world of atrocities and horror was a red-hot energy on the verge of being born. The women had hunger and dreams, demands and a vision. They conceived of a place, a concept called City of Joy. It would be their sanctuary. It would be a place of revolution, of safety, of healing, of gathering strength, of coming together, of releasing their pain and trauma. A place where they would declare their joy and power, a place where they would rise as leaders. I, along with my team and my extraordinary board at V-Day, were committed to finding the resources to help them build it. We worked. We began the construction, which was arduous and seemingly impossible, delayed by rain and lack of roads and electricity, corrupt building managers, and rising prices. We were scheduled to open in May, but on March 17, 2010, they discovered a huge tumor in my uterus. Cancer threw me through the window of my disassociation into the center of my body's crisis. The Congo threw me deep into the crisis of the world. And these two experiences merged as I faced the disease, and what I felt was the beginning of the end.
So it is clear that these two narratives, these two stories, these two women come from very different places to where they are now, and that the paths you chose were both in some way catalyzed by events that even now you have a hard time explaining, and yet you have explained them so beautifully and articulately in these books you must read, as is obvious from those passages. So writing this kind of story, putting yourself out there, putting the personal narrative and interweaving it then with the work, why now? What was the catalytic motivation? Why now, Jody? Because I know for years after winning the Nobel Prize, people ask you, write the book, and you didn't. So why now?
After the prize, I mostly cried. Because I couldn't understand what I was supposed to be. I was very, very confused. I'm a grassroots activist and the Nobel Prize, and you're supposed to be Mother Teresa-like. Suddenly everything you say is a pearl of wisdom. And I kept thinking, no, go talk to my mother, talk to my sister, you will know the truth. It is not all wisdom. And I was very, very unhappy, actually, in parts of my public persona. And finally, when we created the Nobel Women's Initiative, which is six of us who came together to use the influence and access that we have by virtue of the Peace Prize to support women's organizations around the world working for sustainable peace and with justice and equality, I finally liked having the Nobel Prize. I understood it was worth something I could share with women everywhere. And I think it was in that time of finally finding comfort, I started thinking about wanting to share a story of an ordinary person. I'm from a town of 1,200 people in Vermont, you know, and I have warts and failures. My favorite word is the F-bomb. It's a noun, a verb, an adjective, and an adverb. Is there any other that fits that category? My mother has begged me, God bless her, I adore my mother, Italian Catholic, whiner, worrier, if I should please stop using the F-bomb in public because it tarnishes my Nobel image. Hilarious. Watch it, buddy. But I wanted people to know that you can be a normal person. You know, you can use the F-bomb. You can drink. You can party. You can have sex, drugs, rock and roll. I was in college in the 60s, 70s. I didn't do that, of course, because I was raised Catholic. I have a real problem when people who participate in global change are lionized. Suddenly, Martin Luther King is one of the ones that I think about a lot because he's ours. He was a wonderful, normal human with complexities and faults and wonders like everybody else. And now he's a granite statue who, you know, the impression that is given almost is that he solely took on racism. He and maybe Rosa Parks on the side. But it was thousands and millions of people. And when that happens, it makes ordinary people like ourselves believe that we couldn't possibly aspire to that. It disempowers. And I wanted people to understand there's nothing magic about it. You just get off your butt. Really. You don't want it to keep spreading. I keep trying to make mine shrink. It ain't working. You get up, you join with an organization of people that are sharing the same goal on the same issue you care about, you volunteer. Mm-hmm. And together, you can make massive change in the world. It's not magic.
I want to come back to that, mm-hmm. to that particular kind of activism that you chose. And while the life is ordinary or normal, as you described, there were things that we'll come back to that put you on the path. So, Eve, you've written many books.
She didn't answer the question, though.
Why
now?
Because I became comfortable with the Nobel Prize.
I thought she answered it.
You weren't listening to me.
I was listening. But
no,
why now? Why this moment?
I told you.
Okay.
I was feeling comfortable.
I understood why now.
All right. Okay.
But we'll come back to it later. Right, okay. But right now, why now for you?
Okay.
On this particular book, because you, unlike Jody's particular, way of activism, yours has been through writing, mm-hmm. plays, drama. The thing, you've used the words and the language. But in this book, you are exposed in a way that is way beyond the vagina monologues.
Yes.
So talk about the decision to write this particular narrative and what you wanted to come of it, Eve.
Well, I feel with this book, it really wrote me. I think some books you set out and you have an idea, but I had a diagnosis of cancer, I had a treatment of cancer, and then there was the book. And they feel like they were of a whole. And now there's the book tour, which I hadn't quite figured in, which is actually the fourth stage, which is kind of the meta stage when you suddenly are aware of what you wrote and you're now saying it in public. But I think for me, this book was the most physical book I've ever written. It really feels like it came from my body. And I didn't take notes through the cancer treatment at all because I was too sick. But my body took notes. My body, it was all impressed and written on my body. And after my final treatment, when I went back to the Congo, because we were building City of Joy, and I went back for the opening, the book just started to write itself. And I know now why I wrote the book. There are many reasons why I wrote the book. But one major reason I wrote the book is that my disembodiment, my lack of ability to live in my body, I had seen in women everywhere in the world this separation from the body that is a result of trauma and violence and humiliation. And I think this disembodiment is not just in women, by the way. I think it's in men. I think it's in all of us. I think we live in a state of disassociation. And there's a scan in this book called Somnolence, which is really looking at the kind of somnolent state we live in, which is half awake, half asleep, mm-hmm. here, not here, alive but not alive, knowing but not knowing. And I think it's a very dangerous state, and it's allowed for a lot to go on that is actually killing us mm-hmm. and destroying the world. And a perfect example of that was, I had signs of my cancer long before I did anything about my cancer. I think we all know that when something's wrong with your body, but it's not really going on, you're not really paying attention to it, even though it's completely clear that something's really wrong. It's the same way we look at climate change, right? Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. kind of happening. The fact that we have four different weather systems, in its seasons in 2 days. I was in Toronto, and literally there were four seasons in 2 days. There was hail, there was summer, there was spring, and there was fall. But there's no climate change. Everything's, the same way we walk by homeless people on the mm-hmm. street, and there's not economic, injustice everywhere. And I think part of writing this book for me was an amazing thing happened in my cancer journey is I came into my body. I landed in my body. I woke up after 9-hour surgery, and for the first time, I was body. And as scary it was, because I was all tubes and catheters and things, I was in my body. And it was exciting. And that journey that went through the treatment made me, it changed me. It changed my life. It connected me to Earth, and it connected me to my sister, and it connected me, the irony of this radically, this disease, which is about psychotically subdividing cells, connecting me to everything around me, was, and I wanted to share it, because I actually feel if we do not come into our bodies, if we do not really become associated with ourselves, we're not going to be associated with each other, and we're not going to be connected to the earth, and we're not going to act on behalf of all the things that needed to be acted upon. So it was a way of telling that story so that hopefully this isn't a do-it-at-home manual. You know, you don't get catastrophic cancer and come into your body. You actually read the book, and it's a wake-up call. So that doesn't have to happen.
And illness so often is. And as you say, it's too bad that and tragic that sometimes we have to have those kind of terrible things happen. And Jody, you don't make a big point about that, but in fact, you too had a life-threatening bout with cancer.
Well, on Valentine's Day in 2011, which is of course a fake holiday to make us consume more and more.
Except it's V-Day, too.
Except it's V-Day,
all right,
too.
All right. Yeah. Sorry.
Hello. Yeah.
Sorry. I grew up with the Valentines in grade school. My husband was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And 5 weeks later, right before his surgery, I was diagnosed with breast cancer, which is kind of really awkward, you know? And I, you know, being a man, he had one surgery and it was all cool. Being a woman, I've had four, and I'm going to have another one. But it wasn't life-threatening. I was very fortunate, and get your mammograms. I had no lumps. I had no nothing. If I had not had a mammogram, I would still be walking around with breast cancer. And by then, it would be terrible. But I wrote the second half of the book when I was in between the surgeries because I could focus on that and not have to travel to a jillion countries and do the things I do.
But it did impact the way you looked at life or not?
No, I really didn't. Neither Goose, my husband, nor I felt fear. And I think that's part of my dissociation, which I do not want to give up. My oldest brother was born deaf, and in adolescence he developed paranoid schizophrenia and became violent in the home. And it is in the book. But, of course, it marked my family. You can't have a violent person in the home trying to strangle your mother with a telephone cord several times, chasing me and her out of the house with a butcher knife, and not have some impact. But my response to it was emotional dissociation from that kind of experience. And it has served me well. I'm completely serious. My sister, Mumu, who is a nurse, was a psych nurse for quite a few years, many years ago. And one day she came over to me and she said, Jody, you have to deal with the emotional trauma of our childhood with our brother. And I looked at her and I said, F you, Mui, I love you. But I am very functional. You know, I've helped create the landmine campaign. I don't want to sink into, you know, decades of being freaked out over the fact my brother had paranoid schizophrenia.
But something led you to go to that meeting that night. And you, as you said when you were reading it, you haven't really quite figured it out yet. But there was clearly some association that you made with the violence that was going on in El Salvador and choosing to go there. In your first sort of act of activism. What was that?
Well, my brother, before he became a paranoid, violent schizophrenic, was actually a funny kid. But we, as I said, we lived in a teeny town, and the boys next door, Billy and Bobby, were bullies. And they got particular pleasure out of torturing my brother Steve because of the weird sounds he would make in his fear. And so I tried to defend him. One time I chased Billy and Bobby with a serious desire to beat the crap out of them, forgetting that if I had been able to catch them, they were like 11 and 12, and I was 6 or 7. And it was two boys, and, you know, I would have had the crap beaten out of me. But I think that was the beginning of my feelings of righteous indignation at injustice and inequality, whether it was the bullies going after my brother or bullies in grade school going after other kids who I started to speak up for, even though I was terrified and quaking. You know, and then it just, you know, it was like the violence of and bullying of the U.S. and Vietnam, and then Central America, and on and on and on. And I just cannot not respond to injustice. It makes me mental to sit back and do nothing.
And well, you didn't sit back and do nothing. You organized a global campaign to ban landmines. And Eve, the violence that you experienced in your home was clearly a part of what led you to both talk to other people about violence, but then to begin a global movement to end violence, to have the audacious goal of actually ending it in the world. But something, and you'd worked already all over the world with victims of rape in hundreds of countries. V-Day had already been going for some time. It raised $100 million to support local activists. What happened in Congo that was different? What was that connection that you talk about so much in the book?
Well, I think, you know, I think traveling over the years in so many war zones and being in so many, really the rape mines of the world for so many years, whether it was Bosnia or Afghanistan or Haiti, or I had heard many, many, many stories of horrible, horrible rapes and violence. But when I got to Congo at the invitation of Dr. Denis Mukwege, who's an extraordinary OBGYN, he's an incredible human being and works in Bukavu and started Panzi Hospital in the middle of a war zone and is literally sewing up women as fast as the militias are raping and tearing them apart. I think when I went there at his invitation and I sat and I listened to the stories that were happening in the Congo, it had gone to another extreme place. It was where colonialism and racism and this incredible greed and capitalism had merged and was literally being fought on the bodies of women, you know, where women's bodies were literally being desecrated, not only in the numbers of women who were being destroyed, but the kind of atrocities that were being committed on women's bodies. And most of those militias were from outside countries that were coming in to take those minerals at proxies for the internationals, you know, who they served. And I think when I first went to Panzi Hospital and I heard the stories, I spent weeks listening, I honestly was shattered. I reached a point in my soul where I just really didn't know if I wanted to live anymore, if people could treat people like this, and if the world could be that indifferent for so many years to the fact that 8 million people have died and hundreds of thousands of people. And it was a turning point for me. I knew, of course, I'd been working for years as an activist to end violence against women, but I actually saw that if we didn't focus there and stop there and do something there, that this would spread everywhere and women would become and have become, I mean, unfortunately, everywhere the landscape on which these capitalist wars are being fought. And I think for me, it was kind of where the trauma that of my childhood met the trauma of the world. There was just like a collision. I was there. I was in the center of the whatever that cyclone of trauma was. And it was it pulled me in, and it was inescapable, you know. And unlike Jody, I mean, and I respect everybody's choices, I feel for myself that that disassociation was keeping me away from being in the energy in myself that I needed to bring into the world to do the work I was doing differently. Like, I couldn't be disassociated anymore. Like, I had to come into this body in order to be whole, to be whole. And I think sometimes I look at what violence, whatever forms that they are, whether we have violent brothers or we have violent, you know, we're shamed because of race or shamed because of class or shamed. You know, I think the genius of patriarchy and the genius of this capitalist madness that we're living in is that we get divided and subdivided from each other and ourselves. And the divisions just continue and continue and continue. When you come into your body, what happens is whatever that wall is that's been separating you begins to melt away. And you can't see yourself as separate from other people anymore. You suddenly understand. And it's a connection on a much deeper level than I've ever experienced before. And it's not one that swallows you, like you were talking about. It's not one that consumes you. It's actually one that gives you enormous energy and kind of infinite connection and mileage, because you're hooked up to the bigger river and you're not isolated in your lonely pond, which is what I felt like I was before.
So before, the work came from your own experiences with violence, the kind of empathy that would evolve. But there you didn't, even in that horrific way in which it was playing out there, you didn't give up. I mean, quite the opposite happened. It changed the work, but it also changed
well,
you.
Well, I think Jody will testify, and you'll testify. Women are amazing everywhere, right? I mean, one of the incredible, and I'm sure this is true with all the VDA activists who are here tonight. Like, but yay, yay, yay. I mean, you know, we're vagina warriors. We know we take that pain, and if you become an activist, rather than shooting people or getting, you know, Scud missiles or machetes, you actually take the pain into you, you transform the pain into you, and then you devote your life to making sure it doesn't happen to other people. And I will say that there are many men who do this, but there are so many women across this planet who are on the front lines of movements everywhere doing that work every single day. Mm-hmm. And when you travel the world and you get to show up and meet those women everywhere, it's incredibly inspiring to see women in every condition and in every situation who have managed to turn pain to power, to turn suffering to joy, to turn whatever the madness is into serving people, into giving people, into lifting people and supporting people. And I think it's very hard not to be inspired by that. You'd have to be kind of crazy not to be. Mm-hmm. So I think both those things, I mean, Carl Jung once said that the only way to survive the century is to hold two existing opposite thoughts at the same time. And I love that. It's kind of living in a state of paradox in a permanent way. Permanent paradox, you know? And I think that's what being an activist means, that you're holding mm-hmm. suffering and you're moving forward, and you're holding the rage and you're moving forward, and you're finding the joy, and you know.
But I don't feel angry. I mean, I feel...
You don't feel angry?
I feel righteous indignation, and I feel like it's different. And I don't feel like my activism comes from pain. Mm.
And you don't feel it comes from anger? Anger at injustice?
I was, that's righteous indignation to me. And maybe it's splitting hairs. And I was at a women's peace conference a few years back in Santa Fe. And I can really get on a roll and start ranting, as you might imagine. And I must have been ranting quite vigorously about something, and I don't remember what it was. And at the question and answer part, a woman in the back stood up and she said, I have to imitate her if I can, because she sounded so prissy. It was kind of like, you are so angry. Seriously, I had a hard time not laughing at her. You are so angry. How can you call yourself a peace activist? And I was like, whoa. I had to really think about it. You know, I recently had a vicious fight with my stepdaughter who graduated from university. She's a brilliant student, but she still doesn't have a job. Graduated from university and has applied for one job, and I said, you don't apply for a job. You apply for jobs. And so we really got into an angry fight, and that to me is anger. I was really angry at her, and I want to peacefully slap her.
But
I restrain.
But Joni.
I restrain. But wait a minute. But the what I feel about the injustice in the world is indignation that people will do that. And maybe again, it's splitting hairs. But to me, it feels very different from anger that I feel at my stepdaughter or my sister Mumu or whatever. Right. I want to go out there and shake the world and make people. I feel righteous indignation at people who have the power to participate in change and do nothing. Okay. I feel as indignant about that as I do about the people who have the positions of power and don't care about anybody else, you know? Mm. But it doesn't feel like anger. It feels like something different.
Yeah. But we may just be, as you said, splitting hairs about definitions of words. But one thing that seems clear... looking at the kind of work each of you do, is that you also took very different paths to activism. Mm-hmm. I mean, you, but both very grassroots-based. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what's so interesting about how many different ways you can go about changing the world,
absolutely,
right? So when did you decide that would be your path, that you would join this coalition and that you would take this lead on negotiating a treaty? I mean, you hardly had that kind of background.
My first protest was Vietnam, May of 1970. I graduated confused like most college graduates and for a decade did nothing of interest. Got a couple of graduate degrees, and every time I got one, my parents would say, "You're so smart, go be a lawyer. You know, what are you doing? You don't do anything, you know." And neither of them finished high school, so it meant a lot to them. And what I felt inside that I couldn't really articulate was that I wanted to find a way to stop U.S. imperialism. I wanted to stop the U.S. from invading countries, the CIA from murdering people, to shift government. And I didn't quite know, how do you do that, you know? And that's part of why I was wandering confusedly. And then I got the pamphlet, and that, for a decade, I worked in and out of Nicaragua and El Salvador and began to at least get the underpinnings of how you can bring coalitions together on a global scale to pressure governments for change. And I was actually fortunate that I was asked if I wanted to try to create a campaign to ban anti-personnel landmines. And I thought it was after a decade in Central America, I was a tad burned out, just a tad. And
well, you had also had a violent thing happen to you.
I was raped by one of the members of a Salvadoran death squad trained by the United States of America. God bless America. Yeah.
And you're not angry?
No. I can't make up anger. I don't feel. I realized that it was a political act to try to scare me out of the country. They'd already killed four nuns, American, you know, nuns, buried them, raped them, buried them in shallow graves. They couldn't afford to kill another one. And what they thought would be the thing that would devastate me most, because I'm a woman, would be, you know, to scare the crap out of me by telling, the guy spent hours telling me about his experience as a death squad fellow, and that was terrifying. And then the sexual assault really was sort of like dissociation helped. You know, it sort of like just went, you know, dissociated from the experience and just went, okay, I know what he's trying to do, this sucks. And when he left, I laid down and read a book to try to, you know, not think about it. The next day, the scariest thing was I was in a different part of the capital of San Salvador, walking to a meeting in an area I had never been. And I had been about 30 minutes walking, and all of a sudden this car pulls up beside me, and I looked over, and it was him. Yeah, and he said, "Want a ride?" And this, and that was terrifying to me, because at first with the dinner and the sexual assault, I thought, this is just a total whack job, you know. But then when he followed me, and it was really clear to me that it was part of the death squad trying to get rid of activists. But I happen to be fairly fierce, and I'm not going to let some idiot who, he's the idiot, not me.
Yeah.
And I refuse to leave. Why, you know, giving him power. The sure. power that I have that I refuse to give to him.
Right. I want to talk about power in just a moment, but it's one thing, too, that neither one of you give up in spite of the fact, I mean, this happens. You say, "I'm not leaving the country, I'm staying." Eve, you have witnessed mm-hmm. things that would send somebody screaming into the dark, saying, I can't see this anymore, I can't hear these stories anymore. What keeps you going?
Well, I want to say something, though, about trauma and sickness. I think one of the things that really I learned in this journey is that trauma makes sickness, mm-hmm. and particularly unexamined trauma. And one of the things I think, you know, when I woke up out of 9-hour surgery with a lot of body parts gone and rearranged and reconnected and I really had a deep, deep kind of revelation about, you know, what that tumor was in my body. You know, and I had this image in my head of this huge ball of yarn, and there were pieces of string around it. And each string was a story and a word and something I had heard over the years of rape and incest and mutilation. And then inside of it was my own story. And I think we don't really look at disease and the relationship to trauma. I've actually asked the Mayo to do a study in looking at ovarian and breast and uterine cancers and the connection to violence against women and to see. And I think part of what this whole journey has made me aware of is that I think I honestly took in too many stories. I don't think I protected myself well. I think I would do it differently now, to be honest. I think because I was never protected as a child from invasion and from things getting into me, I didn't know how to protect myself. And so I was very open in a way and very, I thought I had to keep walking into danger, into danger, into danger without learning how to protect myself. And I think there's a way that I do it differently now. It's not that I don't hear stories, but I actually know there are points where I can't go further. And I've heard a lot of stories now, and I'm committed to ending violence against women and girls, and that's what I'm doing with my life. So I don't know that I want to know more. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I can take in more, I think. And that's come because I'm in my body, and I'm actually feeling what's in my body. And I know what my boundaries are, which I didn't know before, because I think when you're violated, all your boundaries get destroyed. And I think one of the reasons I'm able to keep showing up now is because, I don't know if you all will identify with this, but I think when you grow up in a particular environment, and I think this reflects both in the family but also in the state, where you're made to feel stupid or less than or bad or whatever, you either collapse, which is a perfectly reasonable response, or you develop the I'll show you attitude, which is you're never going to stop me. And that I'll show you thing becomes a very driven thing. You know, I'll show you this, and I'll show you this, and I'll show you this. And you don't even know you have a body after a while because you're so busy pushing that body to show everybody that you're not that awful, terrible, stupid, bad person that you were supposed to be. And I think after this experience, that shifted for me. You know, it's not an I'll show you that's motivating my life anymore. You know, it's energy and it's connection and it's a profound desire to make the world right. But it's not coming out of that deeper place that was pushing me past me, you know, past my boundaries, past my body. I feel like I'm with my body and we're together on this journey. And that's why I would argue that I think it is really important to get associated. I know we feel different about that, but I would argue it's essential.
I'll introduce you to my sister, Momo.
It's interesting. You both have very interesting sister relationships.
We do.
Tease you into reading the books because they're very important parts of the book. All right, so we are going to go to questions in the audience, but we've mentioned this word power a couple of times, and Jody and I had a big conversation about it because she kept saying, I'm not powerful. I don't want to be powerful. It's a word I don't associate with. Whereas I know Eve thinks, I've seen the work at the City of Joy where those women take their power so completely and they turn their pain to power. So let's talk about that. Because you each, I know you're not going to like this, Jody, but you each have power and influence.
You already beat me down on power ages ago. I've accepted
power. But it's using the power. Yeah. It's using our personal power and influence, spheres of influence, as well as our passion, as well as our whatever, the love, the experience, all the things that come into who we are to bring about change.
I think everybody has power, though.
Yeah, they do.
I think everybody has power, and I think part of what
What is power? Let's talk about what is it.
Well, it depends.
Yeah.
I think.
Depends on what?
Well, when I was an ordinary girl before I was powerful, you know, I had the power I had was to decide, for example, to protest the war in Vietnam. It agitated me enough that I wanted to stand up in public and express my...
You had the power of choice.
Of choice, yeah. And we all have that.
Yeah.
I recognize now, because of the Peace Prize and because I work with the other Nobel women, the power is has a larger sphere in the world.
Mm-hmm. And you're using it.
Of course I'm using it.
Yeah.
But it feels like I'm using it in a way that helps other people understand that it really isn't magic, and everybody has it, and everybody can do it.
Yeah. So, Eve, how do you see power?
You know, it's funny. I feel like I'm in a way, I'm less interested in that word now than I mm-hmm. used to be. I don't really, I'm interested in energy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested in energy, like how we share and escalate and I'll look at 1 Billion Rising as an example of that, okay? For those of you who participated, thank you. I'm sure there's people here who danced in L.A. But, you know, we had this idea, and it really came from when I went back to City of Joy after my last operation, and I was 30 pounds thinner, and things were really, my body was completely a new body. And women took a look at me, and we just started to dance because there was nothing else to say. And we danced. And the women of Congo danced like no other women I've met on the planet. And they have an ability to dance where they transform energy in the act of dancing. I've seen the greatest sorrow suddenly become the greatest joy, and the greatest suffering become the greatest desire to move forward. And it was really where I got the idea for 1 Billion Rising. I thought, well, what if the 1 billion women on the planet who've been raped and beaten and all the men who loved them joined together on one day, and we all rose and we all danced and we all said, we're going to start. And we put out that idea, and we didn't brand it, we expanded it. It was like, take it, here's energy. Take the energy, go. And what was amazing is that people took the energy in 207 countries, and I think we got close to 1 billion people to dance. And it was energy. It was energy. And I'm much more interested, because power has so many things associated mm-hmm. with it that feel hierarchical and very patriarchal. And where energy feels like it's something that's completely shared, and you can get it anywhere. You know, it's coming all the time, and I think what I saw in, and I've been looking at all the videos that are coming in from 1 Billion Rising, the thousands of videos that are, and you see women in Bhutan dancing with butter lamps, and you see women on the streets of Mogadishu in Somalia for the first time dancing in their chadors and their red short skirts, and you see women who I was with, members of the European Parliament, doing a flash mob in the European Parliament and taking over the Parliament, and how that energy became a globally shared notion, concept, catalyst, idea that spread. And I think that's what I want. I just want to see how we create energy that is transformative energy, that has the ability to move through us all and get us all to do that thing that we each want to be doing wherever our bliss is and whatever our desire is to change the world. You know,
we could talk about this all night long. I want to get some questions from you, but let me... an hour is not going to be nearly enough time for these two women, because we're already just with about 10 or 15 minutes left, and we're going to hear them read another passage at the end of the evening too. So I'm going to ask you to please make your questions short. So no narratives, just questions, please. There are two library... Foundation people who have the mics, and they are going to select.
Hi, how did you balance activism with school, may I ask?
How did you
balance activism with school?
Yes.
Okay, that's a good question.
Getting several graduate degrees.
Yes.
I know you said when you were first in college for undergrad, maybe, that you hadn't been active yet, but I'm under the impression that the both of you began to get involved the higher up you went.
Thank you.
How did you balance? I have to think about it. I went to school full-time, and I worked two part-time jobs on issues related to Central America. It just seemed a logical way to move forward on what I wanted to do in the world.
You know, I've never seen them as separate.
Mm.
Do you know? I feel like I've always been an activist, and whatever I did, I made it be activist. You know, like if I had a poetry class, we started dealing with activist issues. Like I feel like I've always integrated it, you know. But I also think, you know, the more you do, the more you can do in a weird way. Like you get energized and you get ideas and things happen. And I think we tell ourselves, we build these false ideas of limits in our lives. But what I just know in college, for example, I started feminist clubs and I bought in feminist speakers and I was always protesting stuff. And I did a feminist magazine. But that inspired me to do more work and to get deeper into what I was studying. And they seemed to be mutually... Mm-hmm.
Don't get
impacting.
Too hung up on that balance idea. It's way
there's no
oversold. There's no such thing in the world.
There's just energy.
You can't have it all the time. It would be very boring, actually. Yes.
Hi. Oh, hi.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
Okay, no narratives. Quick question.
I love the dancing. I love that stuff, but I feel like there's so much at stake right now. Do we need to be more focused, or should we just dance?
Good question.
Do you want to start?
I believe in grassroots activism and mobilization. I think, just for me, and I do believe in energy. Because the more people you get involved in what you're trying to do, the more energy there is, creative energy, and everything expands. And it's really amazing. But I also believe in strategy. One of the strengths of the kinds of campaigns that I've helped put together and move forward is that there's all the creativity of people around the world doing it their way, but we get together and have an overarching strategy to, you know, move toward our goal. And then we periodically get together and assess what worked, what didn't work, why didn't it, and, you know, we got this positive response, so what can we do with this to make it bigger? I can't function as a political grassroots activist without, you know, conversation with the people I'm working with and, you know, figuring out how we can keep the pressure consistent and the communication constant, because, of course, information is power. And the more you share with the people who want to bring about the changes that you do, the faster you can make it happen.
Eve, you want to respond? Wait, we have only one question. I'm sorry.
I just want to say, like, when we say dancing, let's be really clear. What 1 Billion Rising did was 1 billion people dancing. But let's talk about what led up to it and what's come out of that. In the process of building that campaign, we brought more women's groups together in the history of the world. We brought trade unionists. We brought eco-feminists. We brought domestic workers. We brought farm workers. We brought movie stars. We brought Dalai Lama. We brought every sector of most countries together who had never worked on the issue of violence against women. That is now impacting laws. That is now creating risings that are creating risings. That is now getting people to understand the intersectional nature of violence against women. So that, for example, in a place like the Philippines, where militarization of the Philippines on all the, you know, if you go down the coast and you look how the U.S. is militarized and how that's created sexual violence, that was a major point in all their campaigns, and that has been lifted up. So that each country took the focus of violence against women in those countries and used 1 Billion Rising to draw attention to that. We've seen women get elected to office as a result of that. I can go down the list of the things that are... And we actually have a bigger campaign that we're launching this year that is actually more targeted, that all the 1 Billion Rising coordinators, we had a meeting of 30 from around the world, have generated. So, of course, strategy is involved. It's not just dancing, but... What dancing did was made it clear how many women on this planet have been violated, so that we raised violence against women to be a major issue. And I have to say, like, if you look at how many articles are coming out now on violence, I have never seen so many articles about violence. I've never seen so many reports on violence. It's all connected to creating something in the gestalt and in the culture that is shifting consciousness. And violence against women will only change when we shift patriarchal culture. It's in the DNA.
Yeah.
Next question. Next question right up here.
We have time for two more questions.
Okay. Where are they?
I've been hearing a lot of stuff about women in Yugoslavia and Moscow, Russia, but I didn't hear you mention anything about those women and what they've been going through, what they went through and have been going through. Do you know anything about the women in Yugoslavia? And
I do indeed.
Yes.
I do indeed. And the reason I was speaking about Congo is because that's what the book deals with, but it also deals with Bosnia. You know, Vide has been very active in Bosnia for many, many years because I was there during the war. And actually, the piece in the Vagina Monologues, My Vagina Was My Village, grew out of that, as did the play I wrote called Necessary Targets, which is about a refugee camp in Bosnia. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time in the former Yugoslavia and in post-war. And, you know, every country that's in post-war or post-conflict is going through their own very, very difficult times. And a country that was once a country is now completely divided and subdivided. And there's a lot of, I was just there last year, for example, where everybody is seeking justice. Nobody who was, I can't think of one survivor of rape in Bosnia who has received justice yet. Mm-hmm. You know, I was in Zenica. I can go down the list of Serbian women who were seeking justice, and Bosnian women, Croatian women. Let's go across the world. Mm-hmm. Let's go to the comfort women who are still waiting for how many years? 50 years since the Japanese took women from all over Asia and held them as comfort women. I was with the comfort women in the Philippines who are now 80 and 90, and most of them are dying. All they want is an apology and reparations from the Japanese government, and they can't get it. Go to Burma. People are waiting for justice. Go to Congo. People are wasting. Go to Kenya and post-election. We have no accountability across this planet for sexual violence in wars and in post-war conflicts. And I think that's one of the reasons Jody and I and Pat have all joined forces to really look how we bring about accountability. Because where there is no justice, there is no future where there will be an end to violence.
Can I just give one positive example, though? Guatemala.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah,
I don't know if you've been following the trial of Rios Bond, and it was led by
he
a female.
Today,
well, it was led today. By a female attorney general, Claudia Bassi Paz, and the judge in charge was a woman. He was found guilty of genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes. Hundreds of Ixil Mayans came and gave testimony, which. Being allowed into the court and to be able to talk and be recorded and have him found guilty was liberating.
Yep.
Unfortunately, and not shockingly, 3 days later, the verdict was overturned. I'm sure there will be back and forth, but I spoke to Rigoberta right after the verdict, and she said, we expect it will be overturned. But for us, for the Mayan women, to be able to sit there and look at him in the face and tell him our story.
Yeah.
And we knew he was in charge. And it was the first time that a war criminal was tried in his own country and found guilty. I mean, they're little. It's a little, but it's a big.
And we also have right now Fatou Bensouda, who is one of my favorite people on the planet, who is the chief prosecutor at the ICC, and her mission is now going after sexual war crimes.
Yeah.
And she's doing it. And she's serious. And we're beginning to see women like Zeynep Bankura at the UN and Fatou Bensouda who are really coming into positions where they can make a difference and they will make a difference. So things are shifting. I don't want to be completely negative, but I will say we have yet to see accountability for any sexual war crimes. Mm-hmm. Anywhere. I mean, Guatemala was the first of anything. Yeah.
I'd like to ask about stumbling blocks. You both have clearly come with your passion and your desire, whether it's from your history, from your pain, from your energy. I would assume that you came upon stumbling blocks. You've made it to this.
Just kidding.
you've made it to where you earnestly have a voice. How about for those of us who are trying to get a voice? What do you suggest?
Great question. Thank you.
What do you give us?
But what do you mean by trying to get a voice?
What
advice do you give any of us who hit that barrier?
To be more than a spot on this earth and to really take what you want to make and create change. And I do believe your dance made a huge, huge impact on many people I know, including myself. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So what's your advice to people who want to do more?
You know, this is what I feel. I think the greatest fear most of us have is that people are going to put us down if we do something. Mm. I'm going to really be honest. It's very simple. That people are going to attack you. And they are. There's the news. They are. Even your own team's going to attack you. Right? I sometimes am shocked that I get more attacked by people on the left than I do on the right. Okay? No, it's true. And it hurts. It feels terrible. But part of what I've learned is that you have a posse, you need a posse. You need a group of women or a group of men who have your back. And you've got to build your posse before you go out into the world because you can't do it alone. It's very hard to have people come at you and attack you. You know, on this book tour before I went, I have a wonderful woman in the audience tonight who's been really helping me surround myself and really develop the energy I need. I have incredible friends sitting here who are on my board. I have an amazing board. I couldn't do any of this alone. I couldn't do any of this if I didn't have friends, if I didn't have sisters, if I didn't have people who, when I call them up and go, oh, my God, someone's calling me a horrible name, they're like, well, it's not true. Move along. You know what I mean? Get over it. Get over it. Snap out of it. It's one person and a billion people rose, and I'm focusing on the one person, okay? Yeah. And you know we all do that. You know, 30,000 people can say, I love your book, and one person goes, I don't like it, and oh, my God, they were right, you know? Okay? We all do that. But I think the one thing that holds us back is the fear that we will be put down because it hurts. And the truth of the matter is, if you're going to stand up, if you're going to speak out, people are not going to like you. There will be people. Do you think people love me bringing vaginas to their town? Oh, whoopee, the vaginas are here? Show me a town where they were happy when the vaginas showed up.
So, Jody, quick. Brief advice.
I think some of us are afraid to try to change the world because we want, there's so many problems, we want to be able to change it all overnight or nothing. Get over it. That is not how the world changes. You pick a thing or two things that really blow your skirt up, okay? Above all others. What's blowing my skirt up right now is killer robots, and I just helped start a new campaign to stop them, okay? That gets me so excited.
And not angry, though.
No, I have righteous indignation. Excited.
Excited. Indignant, but not angry.
And but it's starting the same way, bringing together. Yeah. See how much I love my friend.
But never angry. Never angry.
And just to explain.
May I finish?
Yes.
Before I give you the finger again. Anyway. And bringing together people who share the same goal. And I don't care what anybody in the world says about the work I do. I honestly don't. At 13, that was one of the things I decided. I was not going to be a pretzel and worry if Sally Sue thought I wasn't sweet enough or if my friend Casey didn't think I was slutty enough. You know, this is my life. I'm going to live it how I want.
This is another value of disassociation.
Oh, fuck off.
You don't care what people think.
I care what the people I love think about me as a person, but not about me as an activist. That would cause me shut up.
It's going to be a long night with a lot of drinks.
That would cause me to silence myself. It would cause me to censor myself. But if I am working with people who share the same desires and goals on one little bitty thing, then it becomes... Definitely. I would say empowering. It builds energy. But pick one. You can't do everything. Pick one.
Absolutely.
Go volunteer. Just start.
Yeah. Just and read both of these books. That for sure. So I know there's so many more questions. I have so many more that I would love to ask too, but I will ask you please to each grace us with another passage from the book.
No, you go first this time. I did for the other time.
And now you go first.
You people. I feel ganged up upon. Next time I'm going to get my way. It's a good thing I'm flexible.
And be sure and read about the new killer robot campaign that Jody has begun, because it's not the same as drones, even though.
Think Arnold Schwarzenegger in his Terminator suit. Countries are developing weapons that will be able to kill you on their own. Totally terrifying. We launched a campaign to preemptively stop them. Peace. It's a tough word. For some, it calls up images of weak-kneed utopians or tree-hugging liberals or any number of demeaning words meant to delegitimize the hard work involved in convincing people that aggression, violence, and war are choices and not the inevitable fate of humans. They are also words that can cut off real discussion about what peace is and isn't, and what it would take to build sustainable peace. Real peace is not simply the absence of armed conflict, but it took me a long time to fully understand that. When I protested against the war in Vietnam in 1970, I was protesting to end the war, not war. I wasn't thinking at all about sustainable peace or a concept of human security, which is much, much bigger than the security of the state alone. Some describe human security as ensuring that people everywhere are free from want and free from fear. It also entails protecting this planet because it's the only one we've got. Human security requires redirecting our resources toward providing for the basic needs of human beings so that they are secure in their daily lives. For too long, security has been defined in terms of the security of the state, not of its people. We call it national defense. To achieve such change, we have to start educating people to see that war is nothing to glorify. Individuals may be fantastically heroic in war, but there is nothing heroic about war itself. It is a grisly, brutal endeavor generally revolving around power, whether to gain it, maximize it, or maintain it, and grabbing other people's resources. If war and all its consequences were to be honestly faced, how many people would go to war? To make war palatable, it is usually wrapped up in banners of democracy, freedom, and liberty, or other such terms to dress it up in glory. But if we need to understand that war isn't glorious, we also need to understand better what peace is. Peace is not kumbaya, a dove, or a rainbow. Nor is it bad peace poetry that people send me all the time, I must say. Terrifying. When I think about a dove and a rainbow, I think about serenity. But serenity, personal peace, is not sustainable world peace. Confusing serenity with creating peace can make it even harder to really understand what it takes to change how we think about war and peace. Working to create a world with sustainable peace is hard work every single day. It means thinking in terms of human security, people, not national security. It means demilitarization, another dirty word, and using our resources for productive ends for us all. When I hear people scoff at peace, I think of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and all the work he did to end racism and inequality and of his opposition to war. I think of Rosa Parks and the thousands of others who took nonviolent action along with Dr. King. There's nothing weak-kneed about that. When people say peacenik with scorn, I think of Gandhi, who helped end an empire through the nonviolent actions of the tens of thousands he inspired to participate in making change happen. I think of Nobel Peace Laureates Betty Williams and Mairead Maguire of Northern Ireland, who helped bring out tens of thousands of people, mostly women, to protest the violence of the Troubles there. Their nonviolent action contributed to the restoration of peace in Northern Ireland. When people want us to believe that peace is something for the faint of heart, I think of other giants of peace, like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Nelson Mandela, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Sir Joseph Rotblat, Aung San Suu Kyi, and the late professor, my dear friend Wangari Maathai. With moral fortitude and through nonviolent action, they have helped shift thinking and policies in our world. That's what real peace is.
And thank you, Jody, for continuing your efforts to bring that kind of sustainable peace to the world.
Even if I'm horribly emotionally fucked up.
I just want to say that I truly love Jody, and for many, and I actually wrote the foreword to her book because I love her so much, and I love her fortitude, and I love her tenacity, and I love how committed she is every single day of your life, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart. And I love this woman here a lot, and we've been on a long, long journey together, and I feel so happy to be here tonight with her. One of the things I want to close with, since you close with peace, I'm going to close with love. You know, one of the great things that happened in this cancer conversion journey is I got reconnected to a lot of things. I got connected to trees, and I fell in love with nature, and I found my way back to the earth. And I got reconnected to my sister, who I'd been separated from because of my tyrannical father who had divided us. And we fell in love with each other over the course of the treatment. And I think my whole life I had an idea of love that was really sort of like the way I saw trees. It was disembodied. And I just want to read this last section. It's from a chapter called A Burning Meditation. It's from a scan called A Burning Meditation on Love. Before cancer, love was something you succeeded or failed at. It was like a corporate activity. You won or you lost. People loved you and then they didn't. As with the trees, I had missed the point. The men I, in theory, had loved and who, in theory, had loved me had all disappeared. After years of involvement, not one found his way to my loft during those long burning months. I received a 2-line email from my first husband of 15 years, a card from a partner of 13 years, and no word from another lover of equal duration. Later, I heard he was insulted I hadn't reached out to tell him I had cancer. No blame, just the facts. I had failed at love, or at the story I had bought about love. As I rode my burning body down to the bottom of the world, I passed through the ghosts and glories of those love affairs, hideous moments and tender ones. Honestly, not much remained. No resentments, no longings, and that was most painful. To think that at 56 I had come to this, no lover, no mate, and no nurturing memories. Despair burned in me. There were days when the leaves of my romantic failings made a bonfire inside me. The story I had been living about love was now clearly over. The landscape was charred. There was no way forward or back. While this fire raged in me, some other alchemic dance that I could not even recognize was happening all around me. It was MC cooking me soft-boiled eggs at 5 a.m. to calm my stomach. It was Amy, who I hardly knew, stopping by unexpectedly to rub my feet. It was Nico coming from Italy for an entire month and turning my loft into a summer ashram. It was Carol sending me weekly boxes of silky pajamas. It was Donna spoon-feeding me soup in the wretched Sloan Kettering. It was Avi and Naomi showing up with pajamas and Bolivian quinoa. It was my daughter, my granddaughter Coco, packing my suitcase the night before I would see my mother for the last time. It was Pat contacting Dr. Deb and getting me into the Mayo Clinic. And it was Toast. It was Toast with the devotion of Kent in King Lear, who kept me gently engaged in fighting, always there, never wavering, never complaining. This daily, subtle, simple gathering of kindnesses stretched out across the chemo days and months was, in fact, love. Love. Why hadn't I known that was love? I was always reaching for love. But it turns out love doesn't involve reaching. I was always dreaming of the big love, the ultimate love, the love that would sweep me off my feet or break open the hard shell of my lower self. The love that would bring on my surrender, the love that would inspire me to give everything. As I lay there, it occurred to me that while I had been dreaming of this big love, this ultimate love, I had, without realizing it, been giving and receiving love for most of my life. As with the trees that were right in front of me, I had been unable to value what sustained me and fed me and gave me pleasure. And as with the trees, I was so busy waiting for and imagining and reaching and dreaming and preparing for this huge, big love that I had totally missed the beauty and perfection of the soft-boiled eggs and the Bolivian quinoa. So much of life, it seems to me, is in the naming and framing of things. I had been so busy creating a future of love that I never identified the life I was living as the life of love, because up until then I had never felt entitled enough or free enough or honestly brave enough to embrace my own narrative. Ironically, I had gone ahead and created the life I secretly must have wanted, but it had to be covert and off the record. Chemo burned away the wrapper, and suddenly I was in my version of life. Thus began the ecstasy, the joy, the pure joy of a spiritual pirate who finds the secret treasure.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.